Good afternoon and welcome to KALW's Open Air, our weekly dialogue of the performing arts here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be talking with some of the creative artists involved in the Opera San Jose 2016-17 season, including General Director Larry Hancock, Kirk Doherty, tenor in residency, as well as Ben Spearman, one of the directors of the opera programs. We'll also hear about the new season of Cabaret at the Fairmont. Maren Levinson talks about Bay Area Cabaret's opening featuring Kelly O'Hara. Plus, we'll hear from Ronit Widman-Levy about things happening down at the Oshman Center down in Palo Alto. Stay with us. Is the stellar voice of tenor Kirk Doherty, a role that marked his debut at the 2015-16 season as Opera San Jose. Cavaradossi singing Recondita Armonia. Brilliantly done. You also performed as Don Jose in Carmen and as Mitch in A Streetcar Named Desire last season. And your first performances at San Jose were part of the 2014-15 season, where you were seen as the Duke in Rigoletto and The Magic Flute of Mozart and the world premiere of Where Angels Fear to Tread by Mark Weiser. Kirk has also performed with the Anchorage and Sarasota operas, among other groups, various orchestras around the country, and this season, his final season as resident artist, he will perform the roles of Edgardo in Lucia de Lammermoor, Rodolfo in La Boheme, and Sprink in the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera by Kevin Putz, Silent Night, which we'll hear shortly. Kirk, a pleasure to welcome you back to our open airwaves.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
He's joined by Larry Hancock, who is the founding member of this Opera San Jose staff, who was appointed general manager for Opera San Jose in 2006 and general director in 2014 upon the retirement of Irene Dallas. He's taught voice, music app, music theory, and is a conductor as well. Larry also offers a course on opera history for Opera San Jose and gives preview and pre-performance lectures for their main stage productions. For the past 7 years, he's also lectured annually on Metropolitan Opera productions for Fresh Pond Music Tours in New York. Larry, a pleasure to welcome you to our airwaves. Right,
thank you.
To hear about the whole season here. And we're joined by a third cast of characters here in studio, Ben Spearman, who is stage director for two of the season's productions, Lucia de Lammermoor and La Boheme. Lucia will mark his debut as a director for Opera San Jose and here in the fair state of California. He's worked around the country for productions both familiar and less familiar, and is a native of the Bronx, where he currently resides. Welcome to the Left Coast, Ben.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Sure. Well, Larry, let's start with a little bit of a Opera 101 on what Opera San Jose is all about.
First of all, we stick to a very old model, the model that Handel introduced to England, in that we have a resident company. As you heard, Kirk has sung the leading tenor roles for 2 years now, and will sing a third year with us singing leading roles.
And that's a great training aspect of it, and that's part of the mission.
It feeds people. They're not having to wait 3 years between jobs, right? Mm-hmm. Irene Dallas, our founder, her first job in her life was in a little town called Oldenburg in northern Germany, where she was a member of a resident company, which is the standard German model for regional companies. And there she sang her first role was Eboli, Lady Macbeth, Ortrud, all these, you know, hellfire roles.
I guess so, my.
And after 2 years of that, she went to Berlin, where she was there for 2 years, and then she was at the Met, where she sang those same roles. And she always said it was the 2 years in Oldenburg that made everything else possible. Hmm. And when she came back to the United States and then retired and came to her birthplace, San Jose, she said, these young people at the university are ready to go out and start getting professional experience, but where? Where are they going to go to do it? So she was literally herself funding European tours to audition. And then she said, you know, it'd probably be cheaper just to make an opera company. So she founded an opera company. Uh-huh. And that was 33 years ago. And we're still going. It's kind of we all thought it would die after a few years. I never thought I would be there for my whole life, you know. It was my first job out of college. I'm still there.
Working your way up the ranks for sure.
Yeah, not my choice. I've always loved the job I had. I never wanted to move to the next one. When she said, okay, you're the director of marketing. Well, now you're going to be the director of marketing and development. I said, but I liked marketing. She says, yeah, well, you'll like marketing and development. Well, I did that for, I don't know, about 18 years. And then she says, now we're going to put you as the director of production, but we're going to call you the general manager. So I said, on the condition that my office is in the scene shop. Because my office was down the hall from the costume shop. If they screwed something up, ooh, we're out $1,000. In the scene shop, if they screw up something, we have $25,000, right? Yeah. So I'd really rather be down there where the stakes are higher. So they built me a little office down there in the scene shop, and I loved working with the saws and the carpenters and all that painting. I went out and did painting myself and ended up designing a bunch of sets because I just took to it like a duck to water. I loved it. And then Irene said, well, now you're going to be the general director of the whole company. And I said, why? She says, well, I'm retiring, okay? So you're going to be the general director of the company. So here I am, general director. It's my third season just starting now. And I love my job. I think I have the best job in the world, except for budgeting. I don't like that very much. But when the orchestra arrives in the theater, it's the best job in the world.
Well, let's talk about this season. Again, we've got several operas in store, including Lucia di Lammermoor, the opening production. Ben, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your direction of that production.
Well, it was a bit of a unique situation because I actually came on board pretty late. I came on board about a week before we started staging.
God bless you.
But I know the opera really well, and I was already slated to do Bohème. And so when Larry asked me if I could do it, I was able to come here and make it happen.
We had a stage director who had a life-threatening, terrible disaster in her family. And 1 week before, she had to cancel. So Ben was already coming, and I saw that he'd just directed Lucia a couple of years ago. So,
and it's really been cool to come out and do it. And to get to be part of how they do things at San Jose, because everybody really works together all the time. And so for me, the great thing was to come and be part and immediately become part of a team that already knew each other really well. In terms of Lucia itself, the thing that's I think is so wonderful about it is that it is really the quintessential opera. And what I like to do is really look at the material and direct to the material as opposed to directing what I think the material should be. For me, Lucia is such a wonderfully no-holds-barred, passionate expression of human emotion through voice. It was written at a time when there was no shame in just letting the voice, the human voice and the human body and the human ability to express itself come out through the operatic art form. And for me, Lucia just is the perfect expression of this bel canto period when the singing was all. And what I try to do as a director is allow the material to do what the material was meant to do. In this case, it was meant to sing literally and to let Kirk and his colleagues to put them in positions where they can do their best work and express the feelings that Donizetti gave them the chance to express for our audiences. And I think that, and so it's that no holds barred passionate, willing to take it to take it almost to the point where you feel like you're just about to be silly, but not quite get there. And I think our cast has really bought into that. And it's a very exciting tightrope to watch people walk.
Ben Spearman directing the production of Lucia de Lammermoor, which opens the Opera San Jose 2016-17 season, actually. Getting my mirrors yixed up. speaking of puns of words, Larry, maybe you can tell the uninitiated opera fan or a budding wannabe what the old Can Belto is all about. I'm sorry, Bel Canto.
Everybody calls it that anyway. So.
Bel Canto, if you look in a dictionary, it covers quite a long period of time. From the mid-17th century into the mid-19th century. But we who work in the opera business, we don't believe that. We believe it covers the active years of composition of Rossini, Bellini, Donizetti, and the early years of Verdi. So it's a much shorter period that we would say this is bel canto, where voice reigned supreme. But if you're going to be technical and you look all the way back to Handel, the voice reigned supreme then too. So it's kind of difficult to do this. The cool thing about Donizetti is Rossini begins the break with the style that was in practice at the time of Handel, the opera seria. It had changed very little by the time Rossini came along, at least in Italy. And Rossini just throws it on its ear, completely throws out the idea that the aria is the building block and everything else is just a little mortar, and says, no, we're going to have whole scenes that are all sewn together. The orchestra is going to play all the way through without a break, and you're going to have a chorus, and you're going to have an aria, and you're going to have some recitative, and then you're going to have a cabaletta, which is a fast piece of music, and then finish with a stretta, which is a really fast piece of music involving also your chorus. And we'll make a scene of that. And then the basic building block becomes the scene, not the aria. So that's what's going on here. And Donizetti, Rossini, unfortunately, paid no attention to the fact that the text would want a particular kind of music. He wrote the same kind of music for that place in the opera, whatever the text was, which means you have happy, chirpy pieces of music to really, I'm going to tear out your heart and feed it to the dogs, and it's all happy. That happens in Rossini's serious opera, so it's kind of hard for us to do Rossini serious works. Donizetti is the bridge to get us from that into Verdi. So there's still a little bit of happy music with not very happy text, so that makes it hard for a stage director. I know in Roberto Devereux, he sings a very happy tune in the tower while he's waiting to have his head chopped off, so they always direct him as insane. You have to work around the practice of the time. But this is, as Ben already said, it's about the voice being everything. We can't accept that today. We absolutely expect physical motion on the stage. And Ben has done a great job of getting all of our singers to move and interact with each other and carry the dramatic weight in their body as well as in their voice. Mm. But the arias are long. The cabalettas are long. The mad scene is, 18 minutes?
Yeah. Speaking of which, we have your Edgardo in studio here. That's in the true. Form of Kirk Doherty. Yeah. Who is your Lucia for this production, right?
Sylvia Lee. She is from Korea, and she's worked in many places in the world, mostly England and some in the United States. And she'll be doing not that many roles at Opera San Jose of great consequence, but she's singing Lucia, and she'll be singing Mimi. And in between, she's nothing in The Barber of Seville. She'll be covering Rosina in The Barber of Seville, and perhaps she'll go on, but she'll be doing it in the soprano key.
Any next stagehand, maybe. Just keep her busy. I mean,
we'll talk to her about that, I'm sure.
And there's a small role for her in Silent Night. There's only, two women in Silent Night. One is a big role, and one is a tiny role, so she's getting the little role. But at any rate, she's brilliant, and I didn't know I needed a Lucia when we were hearing singers in New York last year. And I wrote at the top of her resume, oh, God, if we only needed a Lucia, she'd be the first choice. Well, the next morning I discovered I needed a Lucia. So
get on the phone.
She's stunning. She's tiny. She's tiny. She's short. She's very slender. Beautiful. She's beautiful. And it's so much more effective when you see this poor thing being crushed by the weight of politics to the point that she loses her mind and dies.
And her brother's played by Matt Hanscom, who's 6'2", and I don't want to say what. And
they're seeing,
he literally is probably twice her size.
Wow.
And so you really, the sense of the brother telling the sister what to do is just even more crushing because you've got this huge man haranguing this little girl, and it just makes it that much more sad.
Well, before we move on to the rest of the season, let's hear a little bit of Donizetti and the ultimate Lucia in the form of Maria Callas.
Cool.
Could you introduce the... I love this scene because it starts with a flute solo, and I'm a flutist, so we'll hear Isabel, the wonderful Isabel Chapuis down at Opera San Jose, but we'll hear Maria Callas singing the Mad Scene. Could you set what's going up on that?
Okay, well, Lucia has fallen in love with a guy named Edgardo, and his family used to own the land where her family now lives. We have set the opera in 1485, the time of the Battle of Bosworth Field, when Henry VII killed Richard III, and suddenly there's a violent change in the political continuity. And the Ashton family, she's Lucia Ashton, the Ashton family's been on the wrong team, and suddenly they find themselves in physical danger. Henry Ashton will be killed because of his complicity with Richard III. And so he's terrified for his life. So he has arranged a wedding for his sister and Arthur Bucklaw, who's aligned with the Tudors. So to save his life and his family and what they have managed to acquire under the reign of Richard III, he needs her to marry. But she has already wed Edgardo privately in the forest.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not blessed by the church, but that didn't matter in the Middle Ages. Two people pledged their troth. They were married in heaven and on earth, and that was the end of it. So she is being forced into a marriage which will damn her soul to hell forever. And she loves somebody else. And she loses her mind in the midst of all this, all the pressure of having to get married.
Uh-oh. Well, she hasn't gone quite mad yet, but we'll have to leave it at that.
Oh, she's close. She'll be there real soon.
Close, yeah.
She's already, you know, maybe covered in blood, although Callas probably wasn't, but no
Maria
worries.
Callas from a live Rome recording Rome Radio performance in 1957. We'll hear Sylvia Lee perform that role for Lucia de Lammermoor, which has its run September 10th to the 25th here in San Jose. I was going to say San Jose and San Jose. I got getting those roles. Edgardo is being sung by tenor Kirk Dougherty. Kirk, quite a bit of experience under your belt just working with Opera San Jose.
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely grateful for the diversity of roles that that I've got to experience and perform. And it's always such a great group of people. We have many people that return to us and perform these productions, and it's always a great time. It's sort of a reunion, because many companies, you work for 6 weeks and you go on to the next company. Sometimes you meet, sometimes you don't. But it makes a great feeling for the production, and you're not always just starting at zero. You're always starting at a positive then.
Mm-hmm. And Larry, is that a typical stint for your residents, three seasons, four seasons? Or does it vary?
Four is maximum. We wouldn't allow a singer to stay past four seasons. Three seasons is rather typical. And it's more typical these days because there's so little work out there. Singers are just not there. There's so many fewer opera houses than there used to be. Two seasons if they're really stellar.
All right. Well, there's high praise for Kirk Dougherty, tenor. Ben, you're also directing the production of La Boheme. Also in the season for Opera San Jose is Silent Night by Kevin Putz.
We are so pleased. We are so pleased to be bringing this opera. It's a fascinating topic, the whole idea of it, the spontaneous Christmas truce of 1914 in the trenches of France. And I was able to see a PBC broadcast of this thing, and I went crazy for it, and then flew to Kansas City and saw it. Got the message back to Minnesota Opera, who had sent me the PBS recording, and said, we would love to do it, but we can't do it because the orchestra pit, our orchestra cannot handle an orchestra of this size. It was a lot of players. And there's three armies on stage, so that's kind of a challenge too. But Mr. Putz sent me an email saying, well, how many people will your pit hold? I said, 47. He reduced it to 47
wow.
players.
That's great.
And we can't use the scenery and costumes from Minnesota because we have a 1,000-seat hall. We can't use those giant things. So we're building a whole new production. So we have all new scenery, all new props, all new costumes, and a reduced orchestration. So suddenly this opera can be made available to small companies across the nation. You don't have to
nice.
Be the San Francisco Opera to produce
nice.
Silent Night.
This had its a debut in 2011, I believe, with Minnesota?
And won the Pulitzer the next year.
Kevin Putz's Silent Night will be screened, be seen at Opera San Jose from February 11th to the 26th of next year. Also, The Barber of Seville on the production line, La Boheme. Tickets at operasj.org. Kirk Dougherty, Larry Hancock, Ben Spearman, I wish we had more time to talk about the season. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
And we'll have you back again. Here's a little bit of the Silent Night scene from Silent Night of Kevin Putz. Brief excerpt from Silent Night, Kevin Putz's opera, which won the Pulitzer. It'll be screened at Opera San Jose. A live performance, of course, Opera San Jose. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air here on KALW San Francisco. Still to come, regular commentator Peter Robinson will be sharing some information about cultural happenings in the Bay Area. And Marilyn Levinson will talk about Bay Area Cabaret at the famed Venetian Room at the Fairmont Hotel. And next, it's a pleasure to welcome back Ronit Widman-Levy. She is the Director of Cultural Arts at the Oshman Family JCC. Since 2012, she's brought a wide variety of talent to the center, ranging from classical and jazz musicians to acclaimed novelists. She's also an acclaimed soprano herself, who has sung in opera houses around the world and regularly performed with MTT in the San Francisco Symphony, with some Carnegie Hall gigs, with the Chicago Symphony, the New World Symphony, and with Boston Symphony, too. Wonderful acclaim. And she will be one of the featured artists in the season of the Oshman Family JCC offerings. Ronit, a pleasure to welcome you back to our open airwaves.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, tell me about the opening production of the season.
So the first production we'll be doing this season is the Dibuk, which is a multimedia chamber opera. It's our first attempt at a full production. It's a very exciting one, and the reason I've put myself on stage for the first time at the JCC, I find this opera to be a very beautiful story to begin with. It's based on the original Shlomo Ansky tale of the possessed bride.
Well, tell us what a dibuk is.
Yes, a dibuk is a possession, is a spirit of a person who has not finished their business on earth, passed away before their time, and came back to find their tikkun, their place using a body of a different person. So in this case, Leah, the title role, and Hanan are in love. They were promised to each other by their parents, who were friends, their fathers. Yet the vow to have their kids married came before the kids were born, so which is a forbidden thing, to promise souls to each other before they even arrive on earth. So that was that vow that went wrong. And the kids met when they were older, fell in love, and it was doomed. It was on one hand meant to be, on the other hand doomed to begin with. And Hanan practices Kabbalah to attain materialistic means to be able to marry Leah. And he goes into a trance and he passes away, unable to come out of that trance. And he comes back to her and enters her body to be with her. There's a whole exorcism scene. And Leah, the beauty of it is that we want them to be together, even though as an audience we know that means that Leah has to die and to join him. The very unique part of this opera is that the role of Hanan is played by a clarinet player who is an acting partner to Leah on stage.
Neat.
So he speaks to her through the violin, through the clarinet from the other side, from the world of the dead. And she speaks to him in Hebrew and in English. There's multimedia projections in the back by a wonderful artist, Sherry Wills, and the super titles are embedded in the multimedia, so you're being fed as an audience. If the singing is done in Hebrew and the spoken word is in English, and the super titles alternate right in front of you, so you're constantly in the know and understanding what the text is.
How exciting.
It's a lot of love, a lot of mysticism, and beautiful singing, lyrical, very easy listening, a lot of klezmatic folk elements intertwined into the very kind of Shostakovich, I'd say, score. A very unique opportunity for people who don't usually go to the opera to come see a play, multimedia, wonderful artists. We have a stellar cast of performers. The conductor himself is going to be there. He's going to be playing percussion and giving a pre-concert talk alongside...
I'm sorry, the composer? Or
the composer himself, Ofer Ben-Amotz, is going to be there. And on the second night, on Sunday, we're going to have a panel of experts. One of them is Gabriela Safran from Stanford University, who's an expert on Ansky and the Dibuk. Her book was just published by Harvard University, and she is the preeminent authority on all things Ansky and Dibuk. So she'll be giving the audience a very unique opportunity to experience a little bit of her work. The composer will talk about the music, and a rabbi will come talk about demons and vows. So a very unique experience.
Neat.
And beautiful music. And it's a short experience. I think a lot of people are scared by the length of opera sometimes. 3, 4, you know, sometimes even more.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
This one is a nice hour and 20 minutes.
Well, let's hear a little short excerpt of the Dybbuk,
sure.
Music of Ofer Ben Amot. You'll be hearing Ranit Widman-Levy in a featured role in this production on Saturday the 24th and Sunday the 25th down at the Ashman Family JCC. Here's music of Ofer Ben Amot from the Dybbuk. And then more with Ranit. Taste of the music of Ofer Ben Amot from the Dybbuk, which will also feature Ranit Widman-Levy in a featured role down at the Ashman Family JCC on the 24th and 25th of this month. Information at paloaltojcc.org. Ranit, quite a season ahead. I mean, in addition to this production, there's you have the great pianist Laura Magnini. Michael Krasny is going to be in October for a little talk of Night of Talk and Laughter.
Right. We're very excited to have Michael Krasny come back to us. The community loves hearing him, and he's always fills the house with laughter and kind of good, witty insight into, in this case, Jewish humor. I think as we develop the seasons, we find that our audience is kind of expecting a nice pastiche of genres, anything from opera to symphonic works for families like Peter and the Wolf that we traditionally do in four languages, and great jazz. And this season, I'm very excited about Yael Naim coming to sing at the JCC. She's coming with a trio. Yael Naim, if you remember, she broke into our consciousness, I think it was 2008, with New Soul. Steve Jobs single-handedly picked her song to launch the Notebook Air.
Oh, wow.
Their whole commercial, and she became very famous overnight and has since then had a phenomenal career, been twice picked to win what is the equivalent of the American Grammy, but did so in France. Her indie folk kind of energy and style have captured our hearts. And I know that when I was in Italy last year, was listening to the radio as we were traveling, she was on again and again and again. It was so beautiful.
We'll hear her music shortly, but with just a few words about the rest of the season, which includes its full film festival, the Silicon Valley Jewish Film Festival.
Yes. Every year we bring the Jewish Film Festival on board to our community, and we enjoy the different screenings that they offer. We also have Laura Magnani, a phenomenal pianist, is going to give us a great program that includes Liszt and Chopin, and she has a wonderful relationship with our Steinway D.
And that'll be on Saturday, October 1st.
Yes.
And also Rob Schneider's coming in November, a little touch of comedy.
Right, Rob Schneider is coming, and I think the beauty of our hall is that it's truly a boutique cultural arts center. It's, you know, seats a little over 300 people. And Rob Schneider is usually in huge halls with thousands of people. You can probably see him on the screen or at home better and enjoy, you know, a closer. So in this case, sitting in an audience of 300 with your friends and neighbors, and Rob is on stage and telling us about his life growing up in the Bay Area and being the son of a Jewish man and then I think a Chinese mother, growing up with all that guilt and high expectations, as he says. Very, very entertaining. We'll be doing a TEDx in April. We have Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn coming to perform on March 23rd. Lots of exciting things happening for families. Be the Underwater Bubble Show, which is, we're selling out the third show now. That's in mid-October. This is a Latvian company that does this family bubble show slash cirque, and they are the Cats Meow Now in Asia. Their first show in the U.S. will be at the OFJCC.
Nice, nice. That's Ronit Widman-Levy talking about the arts and dialogue season for the fall and coming in the spring at the Oshman Family JCC down in Palo Alto. Information at paloaltojcc.org. Run it. Let's go out with some music of Yael Naim. We're going to hear her sing New Soul. Thanks for coming in and telling us about the season. And I will make an effort to get down there this time around.
Awesome. Nice being here.
I'm a new soul. I came to this strange world hoping I could learn a bit about how to give and take. But since I came here, felt the joy and the fear, finding myself making every possible mistake.
Naim performing on the 13th of this month down at the JCC Oshman Center. Information once again on that series that Ronit Widman-Levy is so wonderfully curating at paloaltojcc.org. Speaking of great music, Bay Area Cabaret has just announced a dazzling artist lineup for the 2016-17 season. Having presented cabaret seasons in a variety of venues for the past 12 years, the nonprofit Bay Area Cabaret begins its 13th season and 6th in its now permanent home of the Fairmont Hotel's historic Venetian Room, which had been dark for over 21 years. From 1947 to 89, the Venetian Room reigned supreme as the city's premier showroom. It was there that Tony Bennett introduced his signature song, I Left My Heart in San Francisco, now a statue in his honor right outside the building. And show business legends like Ella Fitzgerald, Marlena Dietrich, Tina Turner, Nat King Cole had many performances there over its four decades. And it was wonderfully reopened under the direction of founding director Marilyn Levinson, who joins me in studio once again to talk about the new lineup. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, David.
And welcome back.
Thank you. I love being here.
So tickets are already on sale for the opening act, which is Kelly O'Hara.
Yes. In fact, there's so much on sale that they are sold out.
Oh, my gosh.
Except for two subscribers.
All right.
That show, well, of course, Kelly O'Hara is a six-time Tony nominee and a recent Tony winner for her role in The King and I. And this is her West Coast debut. So it is a sought-after performance, and we're thrilled that she's selling so well.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And that's going to be on Friday, September 23. Maybe you can get some bootleg tickets somewhere.
Or subscribe.
Or subscribe. There you go. That's one way to
right.
do it. So after the opening gala, which is on the 23rd, who else is on the lineup?
Well, we happen to have two sold-out shows by Leslie Odom Jr., who, of course, won the Tony Award for Hamilton. And he has just done this beautiful CD, which shot to number one on the Billboard Jazz charts. And that is on a waitlist basis only.
Wow.
However, we do still have tickets for the December 4th show, which is Tony nominee Tony Yazbek. And I don't know if you were there when the San Francisco Symphony did On the Town, but there was such euphoria at the end of it, and he was such a big part of it. He's a throwback to the past. Of course, he's a singer, dancer, actor, the new Gene Kelly. But he also lends a sort of modern sensibility to his dancing and his performing. And he's going to be doing some tap in addition to his singing in the Venetian Room.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. And then on the 29th of January, there's a fabulous singer, Carmen Cusack, who was Tony nominated for Steve Martin and Edie Brickell's Bright Star just now. And hers is a real rags-to-riches sort of story where she's been around for a while and she's taken on roles like Elphaba in Wicked, Fantine in Les Mis, Christine Daae in Phantom of the Opera. She's one of a number of children. Her mother was a teenager when she was born, just like the character in Bright Star. And now she's got her big break with this show. So audiences will be treated to her beautiful voice on the 29th of January. And then on the 12th of February, we have a special event, an Australian cabaret artist named Michael Griffiths, who does a biographical piece on Cole Porter. Sounds very dry when I describe it, but actually he won the Adelaide Fringe Festival Award for this piece, which delves into not only Cole Porter's happy side, but also his issues with alcohol and a sexual orientation. And anyway, it's a very, very exciting show. And then on March 5th, we're doing something we've wanted to do for a very long time, which is to celebrate the art of cabaret by bringing in Don't Tell Mama's booker, Sidney Meyer, who is a hilarious performer himself. I've seen him perform at the Mabel Mercer Foundation's Cabaret Convention and MAC Awards. And so he's going to be our host. And we'll have Amanda McBroom, who, of course, wrote The Rose, a Grammy winner, who's a wonderful storyteller in song. Nicholas King, who's an up-and-coming young cabaret artist, won lots of awards in that field. Carol J. Bufford, who is a bluesy cabaret singer, also award-winning. And that's going to be a night of discoveries. That's on March 5th. And on the 26th of March,
John Pizzarelli and Jessica Mulaski, favorites. We have them every single year just because they are so popular, and people make an annual tradition seeing their show at the Venetian Room. This is going to be their newest Cafe Carlyle show that they'll perform that night.
Nice. Oh, it's so wonderful that you brought the Venetian Room back to life, and congratulations on the work you're
doing
there.
Thank you.
BayAreaCabaret.org is the place to learn more. Let's hear a little bit of Kelly O'Hara sing from The King and I for her Tony Award-winning performance for Best Leading Actress in a Musical. She's going to be featured on the 23rd opening gala of Bay Area Cabaret. Subscribe for tickets is the best way to do it, and you can learn more at BayAreaCabaret.org. Marilyn, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, David.
I do not know you well, but when the music started, something drew me to your side. So many men and girls are in each other's arms. It made me think we might be similarly occupied. Shall we dance on a bright cloud of music? Shall we fly? Shall we dance? Shall we then say goodnight and mean goodbye? Oh, perchance, when the last little star has left the sky, shall we still be together with our arms around each other? And shall you be my new romance? On the clear understanding that this kind of thing can happen, shall we dance? Shall we dance? Shall we dance?
Why do you stop? You dance pretty. Go on, go on.
No, no, go on. Your Majesty, I didn't realize I was... Well, after all, I'm not a dancing girl. In England, we don't... That is, a girl would not dance while a man does...
Kelly O'Hara from her Tony Award-winning performance of The King and I that was performed on Broadway. She's part of the dazzling lineup of the Bay Area Cabaret, bayareacabaret.org, for more information. Paperback writer, perfect introduction to my next segment with regular contributor Peter Robinson, who's going to talk about some new titles as well as some book offerings. Hi, Peter. Welcome back.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And yeah, just listening to those words, paperback writer, reminds me I've just finished reading the Pew Center, that's the Research Center on Publishing and Books, for 2016. It came out last week. And they have some interesting statistics that reading is definitely up. I say that because we do live in a world of Facebook, Netflix, and other digital distractions. And real books, the books that you actually hold in your hand, are also on the increase. In fact, according to the survey, over the past 12 months, 73% of the population here in this country read a book. Now, statistically, women make better readers than men, probably 77% against 66%. And growing in kind of, I guess, traveling increase is a 14% people listened to audiobooks. So you've got a good stretch of how formats for the book may be changing in our digital age, but still we like to turn a page, we like to hold it in our hands, we like to digest the text. And all this, for those who are interested, can be found in last week's Pew Center research on the nature of publishing, the printed book, and other forms. Now, that takes me, of course, back home here to the Bay Area, and San Francisco is a great reading city. And one way that you get to meet fellow readers is in a book club. So over the last week or so, I've been looking around at some of the different places you can find a book club which might work for you. And one place to start is Books, Inc. They, in fact, sponsor over 30 different types of book clubs, both in the East Bay here in the city and down south to Palo Alto. For example, at Chestnut Street, the Classic Book Club meets there, and amongst their choices, starting next week, is Their Eyes Are Watching God, the Zela Nora Hurston book. If you go to Opera Plaza, they have a Current Affairs book club, which meets on a regular basis. And if you want to cross the bridge into Marin, Book Passage, one of the great independent bookstores, runs about 12 to 13 different types of book club events. So let me just mention a couple of them. The first is called Reading the Poets, and this is by John Hart. Meets on a Monday evening at 7. And you not only get to read a poem, but you also get to analyze, discuss it, and meet other people who obviously have an interest in poetry. Another interesting book club, which meets also at Book Passage, is by Pamela Fien-Sibler. It's called Meet the Authors. And I think this is slightly different, because she, for the first hour, will have the group talking about the book, but in the second hour, she brings the author in. So you get to ask those questions about what did the book mean, why did this character do whatever it was that character was up to, and you'll find an answer. And that, too, meets at Book Passage, starting on September the 26th at 7 p.m., And I think one advantage, in my opinion, of Pamela's book group is they have usually about 6 or 7 people. And I myself would be in favor of small book groups because it gives you a chance to talk. It gives you a chance to hear other people's opinions. And you're not just sitting there in a mass audience. Back in the city at Borderlands Books is an LGBT book group which meets on a regular basis. So again, interest for everybody, and makes me think one more time, a quote I've often lived and used and I think is really significant. It's from Mark Twain: a person who does not read has no advantage over the person who cannot read.
Interesting.
So that is really what's happening in the Bay Area. Now, what about the world of publishing? Because we are going into the fall, we're going into September, you know, days getting shorter, nights getting longer, so this is that time of year when you can curl up in a bed, maybe with a book. And that's a change, nothing like turning over a page.
Nothing like a warm book.
A warm book will keep you quiet. Well, I often think of that British writer, Trollope, Anthony Trollope. They used to say nothing like going to bed with a trollope. You know, and I think nowadays you can't get away with that, but we've just managed to slip it in. So coming up this fall, 3 tips. I've just had advanced reader's copy of the new memoir by John Le Carré. I highly recommend this. It's called The Pigeon Tunnel. And I think unlike other memoirs, he's not going into total individual details of his relationships, except with his father. But what he does do is talk about how some of the great books were turned into movies. Perhaps the best example is The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. And he has a very interesting study on Richard Burton, what it's like to work with that great but troubled actor, Richard Burton. He also has a real tribute to Alec Guinness, who played Smiley in Smiley's People. And then I think he does a kind of geographic tour around the grand hotels of the year, because a lot of his stories have been set in the Middle East. They've been set in Hong Kong, in Asia. So you get a real insight on this particular writer's voyage. He's now 84. And I think this is one of the best memoirs, not quite written as a memoir. He has a lot to say about memory and how faulty memory can be. So you get a sense that he is a fiction writer, and sometimes, like the rest of us, he never lets the facts get in the way of a good story. So he's a narrator. Now, my second read for this coming season, it comes out this particular week, is by the British writer Ian McEwan. It's called Nutshell. And this is like a retelling of the Hamlet story, but it's seen from a totally different perspective. It's seen from a baby inside the mother's womb. And now you suddenly see life turned upside down.
I think I've read that. A womb with a view, isn't it?
It's a room. Oh, okay, no, you got there ahead of me.
All right. You're setting it
that's,
up.
That's good. So our punsters are here today, upon my word. This is called Nutshell. And it's a very funny but perceptive analysis. It's a different take, I think, on Hamlet, particularly when the father's penis intrudes upon the baby in the womb.
My.
And you get down to the real nitty-gritty of how life develops.
Soon to be a Disney picture, no doubt, right?
Well, it may be with a special certification to go with that one. And my final choice for the fall season, which I think is the great reading season, is by Tom Wolfe. This is Tom Wolfe of the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Again, he's moved a little out of his sphere, and the book is called The Kingdom of Speech. In a sense, it's a serious book. It looks at how we developed speaking, talking, where words came from, how the brain operates, and how does that all work. But he does it in a very humorous and satirical way. And certainly on the tail end, his target is Noam Chomsky. So you're in for something different. It's only 196 pages. He pushes aside Charles Darwin. He writes off Noam Chomsky. He takes us into the world of neuroscience. He talks about words. The book is called The Kingdom of Speech, and the author, Tom Wolfe. So plenty going on. Now, if you want to find out more, I'm going to give you the number of the San Francisco Literary Society. It's area code 415-381-6671. And they can help if you want information about a book club near you. If you want a newsletter sent to you from Book Passage, they too can organize that. And finally, they have an upcoming evening at Sausalito Library called Great Tunes from the Movies. So early on, we heard Shall We Dance from The King and I, where you'll also be hearing Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. You'll hear that haunting theme from The Third Man, the Harry Lime theme. And yes, we're going to kick off with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head.
There we go. All right. Thanks very much, Peter. Fine recommendations all. We're going to go out with the music of Steve Reich, who's celebrating an 80th birthday this year and is a featured composer for MTT and the San Francisco Symphony tomorrow evening as well as Saturday evening. And then on Sunday, an American Maverick, Steve Reich, is being presented Sunday at 7 p.m. Performers include Kronos Quartet as well as Eighth Blackbird for music of all of Steve Reich's music. Information and tickets at sfsymphony.org. MTT conducting part of Steve Reich's The Desert music in the background here. I'm David LaTulip. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Thanks always to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. And if you've got a show segment you'd like to comment about the show, why not send me an email, david@kalw.org. Thanks for listening.